Hello, this is Doris Gilman, editor and publisher of Healthcare Thought Leadership, one-to-one blog and podcast series. On the blog and through the podcasts, you'll discover ideas from in and outside healthcare and the life sciences that you can adapt and make your own. I'm president of Be Seen, Be Heard, Incorporated, that helps healthcare and life science thought leaders express and find channels for their ideas, core capabilities, and solutions. In this podcast interview, titled Medical Devices Improving Healthcare in Underserved Populations, which was conducted in September 2009, I want to introduce you to Sushmita Mukherjee, PhD, academic scientist and humanitarian, who is assistant professor and director of the Multiphoton Microscopy Facility at Weill Cornell Medical College. I met Sushmita at a thought leadership workshop that I facilitated for the NYC Bio Group. Several attendees completed a template that I provided to help them articulate their potential as thought leaders. I shared portions of Sushmita's template with the group. Everyone was impressed by her mission, vision, and plans to proceed on her quest towards thought leadership. I start the podcast by asking Sushmita, what is multiphoton microscopy?
Multiphoton microscopy, I guess if I have to describe it in non-technical terms, then it's basically a kind of microscopy or a kind of optical technology where you can get signal from cells and tissues without using any contrast agents and in real time. And you can get deeper in the tissue than you would with regular microscopy. And to put it in context, you must have heard about whole body scanning techniques like X-rays and CTs and MRIs. The advantage of those techniques is that they can penetrate right to your bones and you can get a lot of information, but the problem there is that the resolution, the size that you can see, the minimum size that you can see is quite large. For example, for the best MRI images, you can probably get about a millimeter. So if you have a tumor that's smaller than a millimeter, you're going to miss it. Optical microscopy is very good in the sense that you can get sub-micron resolution, so you can actually see what's inside a cell. The problem is we are not transparent to light. So multiphoton actually sort of tries to overcome this limitation by moving from visible light to near-infrared light. And by doing very complex optical tricks, it's able to capture this kind of information. And the great thing is what we are trying to establish is signals coming directly from things that are in your cells and in your body and not using any exogenous contrast.
You're a self-described socially concerned expert in medical devices, and you'd like to gain an understanding of technologies that can be translated to improve diagnostics and healthcare delivery among people who have no or limited access to healthcare physicians or health professionals of any kind. Am I correct that we're talking about certain devices being useful in rural and remote populations in developed countries, such as the United States and Europe, as well as in developing nations in Asia, Africa, Central and South America? Please share your vision with our listeners.
First, I would like to clarify that I don't call myself an expert. I hope to be an expert. That's more, I think, the right word. But in terms of the technologies that I'm interested in, it's definitely something that's both applicable to rural and quote-unquote disadvantaged populations in the Western world, in the developed world, as well as in the developing world. And when I say that, I think of, for example, the Roma camps that have been in the news right now in France and Spain and Germany. And definitely these would be applicable. And I think the interest partly comes from the fact that I grew up in India and I studied there until I had my PhD and then I came to this country. And right now I am working on developing this very complex diagnostic technology that's hopefully going to improve detection of cancers beyond what we're able to detect now, cause less pain to patients, things like that. But I'm also aware that in the same world, at the same time, you have children dying of diarrhea. You have, there was a presentation that I heard recently from Doctors Without Borders, and the person who was presenting this gave us a statistics that's really scary. And he said that if a child is malnourished for the first 21 months of their life, something like that, that number may be wrong, but some period of their life, after that, even if you give them proper nutrition, they will never catch up because developmentally they have been delayed. And so that's a very sad state of affairs that we live in the same world and there's such a strong disparity. And I think in terms of technology, technology does exist. People don't have to suffer the way they do right now because technology does exist. It's more of how to bring it to the population that really needs it.
Are we talking about technologies that can be administered to people without a physician or nurse being available?
Yeah, so I mean, my interest primarily because of the kind of research that I do and the kind of community that I move in is primarily with diagnostics. And what I have come to realize just talking to people and reading and also from my own experience in India and also in Bangladesh is for a technology to really work effectively in the remote parts of the world, you need to be, you need to sort of not depend on presence of a trained physician or nurse. You need to be off the grid in the sense that you cannot expect to have constant access to power. You cannot depend on having good roads, so it cannot be something that's very bulky, something that doesn't need constant refrigeration. So all these are concerns. And putting all of this in context, I think there are two lines of technology that I see, or two approaches that I see that would be very adaptable to these situations. One is mobile technology, because it's kind of interesting that even in the remotest parts of the world where no roads, no reliable electricity, there is cell phone coverage. So, and cell phones are being used more and more for, so telemedicine is becoming a very popular thing. And the other thing is solar cells, because a lot of these places, there's no constant access to power, and solar technology has really developed to a point where it can be used to create energy where it's needed locally.
Are there any demonstration projects going on right now that exemplify what you're talking about?
Oh yes, there are actually a lot of different people who have developed this type of technology and are testing them in the developing world, including solar power to refrigerate vaccines, for example. There's a big project on that. There is actually, there was this paper that I covered in my blog, which was to me very fascinating, where they used a cell phone and the built-in camera in a cell phone to image blood smears from people for diagnosis of malaria and tuberculosis and things like that. And the great thing with integrating with a cell phone is that then you can use that same cell phone also for telemedicine, in the sense that you can transmit those images to experts who may be anywhere in the world and get real-time feedback from them in terms of diagnosis. So it really sort of opens up this remote corner of the world to the whole world, which mm-hmm. to me is really fascinating.
So what kinds of devices and diagnostics do you think lend themselves towards improving health care among underserved and developing populations? I would think there, you know, you'd be thinking about things that would serve a very large large demography, as opposed to something very narrow, even, you know, detection of cancer, things like that, something more along the lines of prevention and early diagnostics, certain kinds of interventions for children, that type of thing.
Yeah, so in terms of the kinds of technology that do lend themselves to this type of intervention, and you're absolutely right that it has to serve a large population, both because the need exists and also because of scalability. Because to develop this type of technology to serve hundreds or even thousands of people may not may not be scalable economically to make it feasible, but when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people, then you're starting to involve governments and nonprofits, large nonprofits, and thereby get to a point where it becomes something that's sustainable. In terms of technology, as I said, anything that's mobile phone-based, and especially using the camera, the SMS technology, there's a whole nonprofit movement with text messaging, SMS, which is a freely accessible SMS technology specifically geared for nonprofits to share information in the field. For example, if you have health workers who are in the field and have gone to visit somebody in the village who's 20 miles away and the person is not doing well, they can send a very quick SMS to the central hospital that's coordinating everything, and a rescue squad can be sent out and things like that. So that's definitely one, the cell phone-based technology. Solar technology is another one. And the other kind of technology that's sort of becoming cheaper by the day and might have major implications in diagnostics are these things that are being called lab on a chip. So these are small microfluidic devices. Typically, they've been built from material that are very expensive. But more and more, you are starting to see people becoming aware that you need cheap alternatives. And there's a lab actually of George Whitesides at Harvard who has now developed the first microfluidic device that's made with paper and scotch tape. And it costs about 3 cents a piece. So now one can start talking about distributing these things on a large scale.
So there really is a lot going on here, and a lot of dedicated people among your network that you network with to develop these technologies, make them scalable and usable for populations. Does this also apply to preventable or treatable medical conditions that are being diagnosed and treated that are really endemic to certain populations?
Yeah, for example, malaria would be a good example. And just to give you an example from my experience, when I used to volunteer with an organization and I did a lot of field work in Bangladesh. And there was this little community we used to work in, which really fascinated me because it was a small community. It was sort of, it was very poor and it was surrounded by rather affluent people. Community around it, and this community it had these drains which sort of took out all the sewage from this community and dumped it outside, and this was before Bangladesh banned polythene bags, and every rainy season the polythene bags would clog up these drains and it would become a breeding ground for mosquitoes. And it's interesting because there was a big movement in Bangladesh because of reasons like this, and the government actually moved to ban use of polythene bags, and incidence of malaria apparently in the small community has gone down tremendously after that. So, and malaria, for people in the Western world, they may not be aware, it's not just the falciparum malaria that is lethal, but even for people who have repeated episodes of malaria, it leaves them weak and unable to function, and children unable to go to school. So it has a very sort of long-term implication in people's health.
So Sushmita, what is your vision? What's your contribution to this field of study?
Well, that's...
And implementation.
Okay. Well, that's, I think, where I am still thinking and still sort of concretizing my plans. I think one of my big concerns from the very beginning has been, I mean, I do appreciate what nonprofits have done and are doing, but I feel there's a limitation, intrinsic limitation in the nonprofit model, and that limitation is that you're dependent on donor money. So you could start a big project and 2 years, 5 years down the line, the donor money runs out, you are sort of almost forced to stop it. Or as a person launching this project and running this project, you spend most of your time collecting donor money rather than actually doing the work. So I've sort of been exploring what other possibilities exist. And recently I read Muhammad Yunus, he's the founder of Grameen Bank in Bangladesh and the recipient of Nobel Prize a few years ago. And he wrote this book, Creating a World Without Poverty. And this book really struck me as something amazing, because there he talks about what's called a social entrepreneurship or a social business, which he distinguishes from for-profit business. And he has very specific economic models of how this will work. And basically what he's saying is that you could develop a social business with two different scenarios. One scenario would be that it would be, so there would be no dividends paid, in the sense that whatever money is being invested, you develop a business, you at least make sure you're not running on a loss, and hopefully you'll start generating profits. And once you generate profit, you reinvest it in the same business or start another one. Mm-hmm. So that would be one model. And another model would be, it would be a for-profit business. It will pay dividends, but your main majority shareholders will be the poor people from the community. So it's actually going to help change their lifestyle and get them out of poverty. So these are the two models that he talks about. And I find them really sort of working with my philosophy, because that's another problem I have with NGOs and nonprofits. Because I have worked in the field in Bangladesh, I've kind of seen that it's very easy for a nonprofit to become patriarchal, to say, like, I have come from the West and I have the money and I will tell you how to do things. And I think it will be great to change the model to this one. How does that work in real world? I don't have a clear indication yet. So I think for this moment, what I might want to do is to create a space, maybe an online, and it will definitely start being an online space, where I will present the kind of technologies that are available or becoming available that can potentially be translated, and sort of create, in my vision is sort of create a cafe-like ambiance where people will come, stop, look at the technology, have discussions, and see what's feasible, and also to come up with financial plans or business plans that would be feasible within this model of a social business. And myself being an academic and a scientist and not a business person, I feel like I'm not really very well qualified to do this part, and that's where I am hoping that other people would be able to contribute more, making this into a concrete reality.
You integrate many disciplines and areas of medical study in your present role as a conduit for communication at Weill Cornell about what you do and others in your department. And what we've just talked about, you, in a sense, are adding the role of entrepreneur to your list. So do you see that there can be a balance between the humanitarian and commercialization?
Yes, I do. Because the kind of commercialization that I'm talking about, I'm more and more convinced that it has to sort of operate within this social business model, which is quite different for the for-profit, free-for-all type business setting. And I see them not really conflicting.
So if you're to come to a fork in the road for your career versus fulfilling your thought leadership vision, and you had to choose one path over the other, which would it be, and why would you make that decision?
Well, that's a tough question. And as they say, the proof of the pudding is in eating, so whatever I say now may not really hold up when I really face that situation. And it's something that I am concerned about, I think about. The thing is, I love my career, I love what I do, and I feel like that's also a place where I can make a contribution to people's lives and people's health. And sort of the image that I work with is that of a dance. So these are the two partners in a dance. And unlike, for example, a classic dance like tango, where you have one leader and one follower, it would be nice to have a situation where one would lead for a while and the other would lead for a while, and it would sort of be a synthesis rather than a dialectic. Although whether that will happen in real world, I just don't know. And honestly, I cannot say right now that I'll choose one over the other.
Well, I think the social entrepreneurism model that you raise might be a good one to study that integrates the two things, the goal with the method.
Right.
And, you know, you may want to keep a close eye on developments in that area, websites, kindred spirits, so to speak, who are pursuing that line of that middle ground between the nonprofit and for-profit worlds. Is there a way that our listeners can help you to achieve your goals? How can they join you on your journey towards fulfilling your mission to deliver healthcare to underserved populations?
Well, definitely, by all means. One of the things is, as I build more of the website and the blog, it'll be nice to have more feedback. Especially as I mentioned, and I say this all the time, is that I do not have the business background, and I think I can come up with concepts, but I know that they are concepts, they're not sort of tested on the ground of reality. So people who have more experience in that realm, if they can contribute more, and also, I mean, just the lack of time, I mean, I have only that many hours, and I have my career and my family and everything else. So even little help with the website upkeep, responding to people, starting discussion threads, things like that would be a big help. So yes, of course, as much help as...
Well, we'll see what we can do about that. Thank you today for your input, and be sure to give us lots of good links for the blog to make some of this happen for you.
Thank you very much.
This concludes Medical Devices Improving Healthcare in Underserved Populations and my interview with Sushmita Mukherjee. This is Doris Gilman, editor and publisher of Healthcare Thought Leadership 1-to-1. Please leave your comments about this and other podcasts in the series on the blog at seen-heard.com/blog. Thank you.